This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Now time for my favorite part of the program, the big picture. Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. We have a guest on the first part of the program, Don Cox, and I think he's going to give us a sobering look at where we truly are compared to where the politicos and a lot of the media pundits would like us to think we are. So, Jim, why don't you lay the groundwork on this one?
Given the world that we live in today, a world where interest rates are the lowest they've been in human recorded history, we see a world today that is falling apart at the seams. Geopolitical risk, with now military conflicts in Yemen added to Syria, Iraq, and the rest of the world. It has probably been one of the more dangerous and ominous situations I have seen in my lifetime. And for that reason, I wanted to have my next guest, Don Cox, who is also a historian, and get his perspective on the world we see before us today. Don, welcome to the program. You look at the world today, it just seems like it's coming apart at the seams, and I'd like to get your historical perspective on that. So that's where I'd like to go.
Well, you're right. I grew up in the Cold War, and what we saw was that the only time that we actually had an air nuclear attack was the Bay of Pigs. And we now know that that was a really close call. Khrushchev was actually thinking of releasing nuclear bombs to protect Cuba. But thanks to Reagan and Thatcher, we won the Cold War without firing a shot. And that gave people the view that we had entered a form of paradise, because we weren't going to be worried about geopolitics because the U.S. was the superpower. It was benign superpower. And so the first interruption, of course, came with 9/11. And what we found since then is that the same technology, which was the preserve of five countries during the Cold War, now you can get somebody as mad as North Korea with not only the technology of the bombs, but the technology to deliver them with missiles. And that technology, remember, didn't come until fairly late in the Cold War. So we have a risk there. And because of the bad relations between the U.S. and China, which are another story, China is basically saying they're not going to intervene. So we've got that one. We've got the Middle East, which the president had sacrificed everything in order to get the Iran deal on the basis that Iran was going to be a force for peace. Very few people believed at the time that that was the case, most notably Henry Kissinger. And of course, what we're seeing is with all the money they've got now, they're causing trouble all over the place, including those Houthis who shot at U.S. ships at the Gulf of Aden. So we have this time that the focus is not in Europe, where in the Cold War it was that we had Berlin divided. And remember those years where the U.S. and Britain supplied food and so forth into Berlin, which was sealed off. So right now, although the European situation is unattractive, but it's not the epicenter of ultra fear. Meanwhile, what we've had is that the new power center that emerged in 2008 is central banks. And people didn't think that much about central banks before. But now what's happened is that the average professional investor spends a significant amount of time every day about what the next move will be of the Fed. And in the European, the same thing. So we have a new international elite group. They went to the same universities. I've been at a couple of central bank conferences, and one of the things that struck me was the central bankers, the people they related to best were other central bankers, and they were pretty leery about dealing with business people. And as far as when you talk to them, they all shared their comments after a little bit of prodding about having to deal with, quotes, their political masters. But they all had the same sort of attitude to their political masters. What they related with was each other. And the one conference I was at was in Alberta, oddly enough, in June of 2008. And I came away from it. We had to take an oath of office not to ever disclose what any of the central bankers had said. But I told my clients at the time, but what I was impressed with was that if we're going to have a financial crisis, this time the central bankers will know exactly who to call in each of the countries to coordinate responses to a crisis. And all they have to do is have their own politicians just give them freedom to do it. So what we have then is these elites, but then they took us on into something that hadn't existed before, which was negative interest rates. Einstein said that the most powerful force in the universe is the law of compound interest. Well, you realize that that works both ways. That means we go in a negative interest rate. That force is self-reinforcing. And I invite your listeners, those of us who are interested in film history, they're history buffs, to go back to a brilliant British movie of 1952. It was called The Sound Barrier in Britain, but it was called Breaking the Sound Barrier over here. David Lean was the director, and he was the greatest British director of our time, you know, Lawrence of Arabia, The Bridge on the River Kwai. And the film was about an aeronautics firm in Britain that was trying to develop a plane to go through the sound barrier. And the CEO of the plane actually flew on the plane the only time it broke through the sound barrier, and it fell apart because there actually was a barrier there. He was killed. And we learned to get around that. We redesigned the fuselages of airplanes then so we could go past the sound barrier. This is a useful metaphor because what we go through the zero level on yields, and I believe that that is setting off all sorts of other forces. Gives us an 18 multiple on the S&P, and we've got debt screaming upwards because you can borrow for virtually nothing. It's not being used to invest in equipment and development. It's used to buy back stocks. So the interlocking forces then that have come out of the crash of 2008 really are situations where nobody actually knew how this experiment would work, but they said, oh, well, the central bankers will protect us. And my fear now is that since all asset classes are heavily priced, but it's odd that the currency values now are back to where they were in the year 2000, they're relative to each other. And we've got NASDAQ is now back up to where it was in 2000. One asset class is 4.5 times what it was when the new millennium is gone. Gold, which is the only asset class which is not subject to any manipulation by governments. So this is a long answer to your question, but geopolitics and central bank politics are things that ordinary investors have trouble with. But I think if you look at what has been happening to asset classes, what you understand is that we have reached the limits as to what central banks can do. And yet we're going to have a recession at some point. The only argument is when. And if we go into deeply negative interest rates, virtually every pension fund that's out there and Social Security will be heading for bankruptcy. So what we've done is we've built everything around protecting the debtors and have said, well, those people who've saved and those organizations that have saved, we're not going to pay them. When they roll over their assets, they're going to be getting lower returns. So we're taking from the rich and giving to the poor and the nearly bankrupt. And this process is self-reinforcing. So therefore, you have to say, well, how are you protected against it?
I want to continue with that theme because we had the 80s and 90s, which has been described as the Great Moderation. Now we're talking about the new normal, where we are seeing subpar economic growth. We haven't been able to achieve 3% growth, 2, and now we're down to 1, which tells me at some point, whether it's next year or a year after, we're heading into a recession. The government built up $10 trillion worth of debt. So another way of looking at that is $10 trillion worth of stimulus. In reference to central banks, we've had QE 1, 2, 3, and now negative rates. And we've been unable to achieve liftoff. So there's something wrong here, Don, with economic policy. We're basically, I don't know what it's like for you, but we spend so much time in the financial world not on looking at fundamentals. Is the economy growing? Is it improving? What's going on with corporate earnings? We spend most of our time, well, will she raise interest rates or will she not raise interest rates? Or the ECB is going to raise or not raise? Or the Bank of Japan is going to raise? So much of our time is consumed on what the central banks are going to do instead of really looking at fundamentals here. But I think there's something wrong with policy, given this amount of fiscal stimulus with a $10 trillion debt added in the last 8 years. And now expanding central bank balance sheets have now led us to negative interest rates. There's something wrong here.
Well, there is. And of course, the other thing is that you realize what would happen to government deficits if rates move back to normal levels, because the duration of the national debts is in the range of about 2.5 to 3.75 years, depending on which country you're looking at, which means that they're continually rolling over debt at very low rates. But if we went back to normal rates, given that they've gigantically increased government debts, the effect on fiscal policy for governments would be near catastrophic. And in the Eurozone, when you've got a bunch of countries, imagine that Italy has the third biggest amount of debt outstanding of any country in the world. How could Italy possibly afford an increase in interest rates? That's just one example where the longer we do it, well, it's like addictions. I have used, as you know, for years, the idea that this is financial heroin. I've used that expression for 3.5 years. And the financial heroin argument is that the longer you stay on it, the harder it is to get out of it. And so I think we're past the stage now where we could get rid of the financial heroin without a period of horrible adjustments. Because the corporate sector also is hooked on the heroin, and they've been borrowing, but they've been tending to borrowing up the sort of 5 years and less. And so the effect on them would sequentially be terrifying. So we're the prisoners of policies by policymakers who are short-termists. And that's the way politicians, by definition, are short-termists. So it's easy to say, well, they had to do this to prevent the world from crashing, and that was true. But they should have started to raise rates pretty soon because of the compounding effects on pension funds. And they didn't do that. And now the amount of debt outstanding, because it was so easy to get the debt, is such that if you raise interest rates, as I say, what you've got is just terrible impact, not just on the governments, but on corporations that have borrowed money not to create any new assets that are going to produce future earnings, but to buy back stock, which therefore this 18 multiple on the S&P in an environment like this, no wonder they're terrified about the idea of rising rates. The only thing that's propping it up at these levels when we haven't had growth in earnings for 1.5 years, and that's the multiple, despite the fact that the multiple is distorted by all the buybacks. So just imagine what would happen to the PE ratios. So this sounds terribly gloomy because it's happened that the news has been bad. Once you lose a superpower, a benign superpower, something bad can happen. What happened in Europe when Britain ceased to be the dominant power in Europe and Germany kept competing to catch up with them and then pulled ahead of them? And well, we thought, well, the Kaiser was a granddaughter of Queen Victoria, so he won't do anything stupid. But finally, that rivalry, they had to do something. And of course, what they did was invaded Belgium. And that's the problem when you have a benign superpower who loses that status of superpower to some other power. And we're seeing that now in East Asia with China. Now that Xi Jinping, it looks like, is talking about not retiring. In other words, he's sounding more and more like a form of Maoist. That is very, very bad news. I have been a China booster since 1998. I hadn't changed my views on China until about 6 months ago. They're the ones, of course, that saved the global economy after the crash. The central banks acted to prevent financial collapse, but China kept buying commodities and trading, and world trade actually grew during that period. We've now had the first contraction in world trade in 20 years. And so that's because China can no longer, you'll recall on earlier broadcasts, I used the expression about China's Atlas, and that Atlas shrugged 2 years ago because it couldn't afford to keep going. So we're now seeing the effects of the huge debt built up in China. And what you don't like is a superpower that's now worried about itself and wants to unite its people. Foreign enemies are the classic vice, then, to unite the people.
I want to move on to the presidential race, because I think most Americans would admit, or even foreigners watching our election this year, is probably one of the most unusual elections of any that I have witnessed in my lifetime. You've got two candidates, two different economic perspectives, two different views of how to handle this geopolitical world that we live in today, which has become much riskier. And then also something that I think it's always been thought of, but I've never seen, where you actually have major network anchors and reporters working in collusion with one particular candidate. I've never seen anything like that. And it seems to me it jeopardizes the concept of a free and independent press. I'd like to get your views on politics, because whoever becomes the next president, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, are going to shape many of the things that you and I just talked about, whether it's dealing with foreign powers and threats, or it's dealing with an economy that's probably heading into a recession.
Well, the media always supported Democrats. I mean, 92% of the members of the national press that are accredited in Washington are Democrats. That's always been the case. Reagan was able to defeat them because he had so much charm, and besides which, Jimmy Carter had been seen as inept and incompetent. But now we have a situation where what they've gone out of their way to do is to protect the Democratic candidate from her own perjuries. It's ironic that she's committed the same sin as her husband, which is perjury. There's no doubt about that now. And yet that's all way on the back pages. And what they're focusing on is women that were groped 14 years ago by Donald Trump. And because they have control of the media, that's the story. And Trump is a man who, because of his egotism, has never taken advice well, and he doesn't take criticism at all well. That's the biggest reason, in my mind, why I was worried about him becoming president, is that he cannot stand being insulted. So it's just a terrible result. Voters have to vote for which of the two candidates is less despicable and less dishonest. You don't get polls, even for the Hillary Clinton, showing that they believe that she's a wonderful and honest person. So whoever gets elected, and it's going to be Hillary, is somebody that is proven to be dishonest. And if the Democrats manage to get control of the House, they're going to get control of the Senate. Then by control of the Senate, it means they're going to be able to pack the Supreme Court, which means that there's no chance for doing anything to stop the spread of all the invasions of privacy that are going on now. It is really a melancholy situation, but as always, you know, we bring these things on ourselves, all right? If Joe Biden had realized Hillary's, how bad her problems were, and jumped in, then we would have got somebody who may not be a genius, but he's obviously an honest man, and that would be enough to unite the country. And as for the Republican National Committee, they should have realized that the only guy there who had a media background was, when you have 17 candidates, he was going to be the one that most of the people would be interested in. So he was clearly not up to the job in terms of researching policy and so forth, but he understood what the elites had done, and he understood why it was that Brexit turned out the way it did, and why it is that Angela Merkel is in trouble in Germany, because the elites in Europe chose to ignore the attitudes of the average people. In the case of the Eurozone, it was about bringing in millions of Muslim immigrants without being able to check them. In the case of Britain, they had the idea that there's no way that the average person was going to go against the elites about staying in the Eurozone. I watched the Brexit returns on BBC TV the night of it. I was rooting for Brexit to go through. And they had a map showing which constituencies went one way or the other. And around 1:30 in the morning, I suddenly realized I'd seen that map before. I'm an historian. That was the map of the vote in the first referendum ever held anywhere, which was 1832, the Great Reform Bill, which is the one that absolutely transformed the British Parliament from one of all elites into a democratic parliament. It voted the same way. London voted against the improvement. The rest of the country voted against. Amazingly enough, there'll always be an England. This vote went the way it did on the Reform Bill. So, yeah. The people, when they're heard, step up there. The question is, can they protect them?
I want to move on to where we find ourselves today. We've seen, as we discussed earlier, The deficit has grown by $10 trillion, and there's implications for that if interest rates rise. The national debt, I think the average interest rate is around 2.25%, so every 1% increase in interest rates means $200 billion in more interest that the government has to pay. It's interesting, Don. I was looking at the government fiscal report for 2015, and in 2015, the debt had grown by $8.5 trillion. And yet the government spent $400 billion in interest expense versus 2008, where they spent $450. So the government is paying out less in interest. But we're looking at a situation today where central banks have brought them down to zero or basically negative in many cases around the globe. We have seen that the economy peaked in the second quarter of 2015. We're now at stall speeds of 1%. Corporate profits peaked in the summer of 2014. So given the fact that we're probably likely to see a recession at some point, what do policymakers do is my first question. And secondly, what if we see a policy mistake? In other words, the Fed continues to raise rates to a point where the economy can't handle it. Or number two, let's say Hillary Clinton, which looks more likely to be our next president, raises the income taxes and the estate taxes as she's proposing to do. What happens then?
Well, it's certainly not going to stimulate the economy. We know that. And what is scary about all this is that she's the ultimate elite. And she accepts advice from all these elitists who have managed to avoid looking at what it was that millions and millions of people would support Donald Trump, as improbable a candidate as he was. And so they're going to go on the basis, well, we've won, so we can continue to ignore. And so we'll continue to impose political correctness. So the divisions within the country are going to get worse in the next 4 years than they've been now. You might say, well, that's hardly possible, is it? No. It is very possible. So all of this implies that investors should not have a view that the past returns on equities, for example, can be projected forward, and therefore that they should have the same kind of view about equities that they've had in the past. Okay, we're 60% equities, 40% bonds type of thing. They've got to say, no, we cannot get those expected return on equities. On the other hand, long bonds are unattractive, these yields. So it is a question of, if you believe in areas of real estate that are still okay, you can find them. And there's no doubt about it, all of this is supportive of the price of gold and silver. Hate to say it, but that's been the best performing asset class since the year 2000. And there's now more arguments in favor of it than were when it was back down at $280 an ounce.
One issue, as we've been talking about debt, and you mentioned previously with negative interest rates, how that's impacting pension plans and I would say even insurance companies matching their liabilities. We have a federal budget, Don, that 68% of that budget is now on autopilot. If you take Medicare, Medicaid, interest on the debt, we have candidates who are not addressing these entitlements. In fact, one candidate wants to expand them and add even another one, in addition to Obamacare, free college. So if that happens, where are we going to get the money to do that? I mean, the government would be in very serious trouble. If interest rates were to rise 1, 2, or 3% and get back to normal in the 4 and 5% range, you're talking about interest on the debt, which could amount to almost $800 billion a year, if not more. So how are we going to pay for all this with 10,000 baby boomers retiring each day? And as you look at Obamacare, more companies are dropping out of the exchanges because they're losing hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. Where's all this money going to come from?
I think you've asked a question to which the answer is, this sounds more like the Weimar Republic than it does like any modern economy. And we know what happened when they tried to deal with the fact that they had those war debt costs that they couldn't meet. They printed Deutschmarks to deal with it, and we went from one Deutschmark being worth almost a pound to a stage where we got up to 10 billion Deutschmarks for a pound. Now, I don't think that will happen, but the answer is you put the question, and it's a question to which there is no obvious answer, and nobody is proposing it. So I think the the best thing for people right now is to enjoy the World Series and the football season and not to lie awake thinking about what's going to happen next year. Because at this point, nobody who's been campaigning has come up with programs that could deal with these fundamental numbers. So therefore, the best hope we've got is if the Republicans hang on to the House, which means they can control the budget, then there will have to be real negotiations on it, and we shall see what happens. But it's certainly in my lifetime the gloomiest situation for basic investment principles. They're all being called into question.
Final two questions. As you survey the world today, give me what you feel are the biggest risk, and secondly, the biggest opportunities. And we'll end on the biggest opportunities because at least we'll be a little optimistic and we could go watch the World Series and football games for the rest of the year.
The biggest risks unquestionably at the moment are in the Eurozone. And if the Euro truly breaks down, then that's going to work across the world. Because remember, the European Union is a bigger economy than the United States. And Britain is still in the European Union now, and they're not part of the Eurozone. But if that area of the world goes into a very deep recession as a result of political problems getting out of control, then it's going to spread across the world in a hurry. And the next biggest risk is a geopolitical risk somewhere in Asia. And you can start at the Mediterranean, and you can take it right over, then jump over to the South China Sea. And those risks are getting bigger by the month. There is no program being proposed, certainly from Washington, to deal with those. So what we saw when the Eurozone got into trouble 2 years after the crash, gold rose $400 an ounce because Greece might be leaving the Eurozone. There's a referendum on December 4th in Italy. If it went the wrong way on that, it could trigger a situation where Italy leaves the Eurozone. And if that happens, we've got a real crisis. So there's the biggest risks, okay?
All right. And opportunity?
Well, you got to have an above average cash position here when you've got risks that big. And I believe that you have to have exposure. I believe now you have to have exposure to gold one way or the other. I'll be candid with you and tell you I got a book coming out in a few months on this subject. So I have to, full disclosure, tell you that I'm a believer and I will be discussing how you deal with it. And then the final opportunity comes where there will be probably a real estate crash and you will get a chance to get some really good real estate assets then, because interest rates eventually have to rise as money flows out. And so if you've got some money set aside for buying a house, wait for a couple of years, you may get a real good deal.
On that note, we will end our conversation. It's always a pleasure speaking with you, Don, and getting your historical perspective, which is one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show today. If our listeners would like to follow the work that you do, how can they do so, please?
They can write to us at coxadvisors.com, COXE advisors, ADVISORS.com. And you can see from the web what it is that we do, and we'd be glad to deal with them. Thank you very much.
Don, as always, a pleasure having you on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his portfolio managers, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Greetings, everyone. John Loeffler here. You know, quite often you hear Jim and me discuss on the Financial Sense News Hour what we call the new normal. But what does that all mean in the real world when it comes to navigating the world's markets and economies in what seems to be a new and steadily changing environment? Well, answering that question is the purpose of our Investment Strategy Conference, which is taking place on October 29th in San Diego. The theme of this year's conference is Approaching the Peak and the Next Financial Crisis. For more information on attending the Investment Strategy Conference and getting this information, that will be October 29th at the Del Mar Marriott in San Diego, contact us at 858-487-3939. Once again, that's 858-487-3939. Or you can email Crystal at crystal@poplava.com. That's Crystal, C-R-Y-S-T-A-L, at poplava.com. Just because things are changing doesn't mean you have to be an uninformed or anxious investor. Well, I was sitting in the doctor's office this week waiting for some routine tests to be finished out, and I get bored pretty easily. And there were a bunch of people sitting there. I decided to see what was going on. So you know what I do, Jim? I always do what I call lobbing a verbal hand grenade. You just throw something out there and then see what happens. And what was amazing, we got onto the subject of the elections, and the whole room came just awake with people wanting to make comments on it. And uniformly, do you know what their one comment was about our elections right now? Isn't this disgusting? It was amazing that the American people are recognizing this. And I said to everybody there, I said, now this is spooky. I said, you have Democrats and Republicans all agreeing on something.
Well, I mean, we'll probably get into this later on. It is disgusting because the media is driving the narrative instead of talking about the very issues which we'll be talking about in this segment, the yo-yo years. There are a lot of pressing issues, as we just talked about in the first part of the big picture with my interview with Don Cox. None of these issues are being discussed out there. The best word you could use, it's more like a tabloid newspaper, the kind of stuff you see at the supermarket. You know, the only thing we haven't talked about is, you know, Area 51.
And you know what I finally realized? I mean, you and I have been in this business a long time, but what's happening now is, say, for example, liberals will watch CNN, conservatives will watch Fox. These are generalizations, but they're not watching the opposite channels. Okay. They do what massages their ears. And as a result, the issues, first of all, the issues that we're going to talk about here aren't being debated. That's the first thing, in other words. But second of all, even the other issues aren't being debated. It's a slugfest between the two media groups, and both groups never hear the other side of the arguments. Usually an argument is tested out, you know, an idea in argument, in disputation, and may the best argument survive. And that's what's not happening today.
No, and that's usually what a political campaign or a presidential election should be. It's about the real issues concerning the country and the economy. Instead, we're talking about locker room stuff that happened 11 years ago, 30 years ago. We're not talking about the email leaks. We're not talking about the disarray of foreign policy. And not only that, what is turning out to be a cauldron of various conflicts that are now emerging in the Middle East. I don't care if you're looking at Libya, the civil war in Syria, now Yemen, where on this Friday we've got U.S. warships firing cruise missiles at missile sites that had fired on U.S. Navy ships, and now we have Iran moving their warships into the region. I mean, John, this stuff is, you know, it gets maybe a couple seconds in the news. Instead, we're talking about, you know, stuff that is superfluous to really the real issues here in this political election.
Especially the things that are going to confront us over the next 4 years, not only in the geopolitical area, but in the economic arena, because as you well know, within about 4 years, most of the state pension plans are going to go belly up just from their own unsustainability. There will be incredible political wailing and gnashing of teeth. We have proposals from the candidates. If you look at the real world of what's going on and what they're proposing, it's like, oh my, they're not really going to do that, are they? You know, you know? And meanwhile, as you said, they're arguing about all sorts of stuff. My wife and I keep walking around here because we have to flip back and forth between Fox and MSNBC and CNN all day to see what's going on. And we just keep looking at each other and saying, you can't make this stuff up. It just gets better and better, you know, as you go along. So anyway, but, you know, let's take a look at that. We need to tell people, and maybe that's the value of shows like this, is that we do tell you what's ahead of the game, just like we did before the crash. Remember that back in 2007, we started talking about the blowout in the subprime mortgage market back in 2004. We were counting it down, you know, and it just came a little earlier, I think, than we thought it was actually going to hit. But, you know, prior to what we've seen, let's go back. Let's do some rewinding here. Let's go back to 1981. Let's do some review here. 1981 to 2000, that would be the period of the Great Moderation, I guess is what we would call it, because we had high economic growth. We had inflation that had gotten tamed after the buckaroo inflation of the 1970s. So we had lower inflation. There were declining interest rates, which of course stimulated growth, very low volatility, and very few crises in that period of time. The one notable thing, of course, was the fall of the Berlin Wall and the implosion of the old Soviet Union due to its own economic unsustainability under socialism. And we also had, by the way, from that time, we had the Oslo peace process underway from the early 1990s that took us up right to about 2000. And everybody in the Middle East was behaving themselves for the most part. So as you said, few crises going on around the world. Then we changed all that and went through a period of abruptness. We had 9-1-1. We had the collapse of the Oslo peace process, various things in the Middle East, radical changes, a couple of wars going on. And now, of course, this has just blown up after the Arab Spring into something even bigger. 2009 to the present, we've been calling the new normal. We saw lower economic growth, lower inflation, declining interest rates to record lows, but more importantly right now, much higher volatility. And if you look, Jim, the geopolitical situation grows more unstable day by day. So that's where we are. And these are the real issues that are confronting us, by the way, in the midst of everything else that we hear the candidates talking about. So we need to frame this for everybody.
I think what happened after maybe two decades of what would be relative stability, not only for the economy, but also for the markets and also geopolitically, because the U.S. won the Cold War, there was a feeling that basically central bankers had tamed the business cycle, because we would go almost a full decade in between recessions versus what had transpired previously, where the business cycle lasted 3 to 5 years. And there were a number of things that were going on during that period of time that contributed to the Great Moderation, which are much, much different than the world that we find ourselves in today. Number one, the U.S. economy was transforming itself from a manufacturing to a service economy to a financial economy, because financialization of the economy expanded in the 80s and 90s and, of course, the last decade, where you had, you know, back in the days when you went to go get a mortgage, at least I can remember when we bought our first home, we actually walked into a bank. We sat across the desk, talked to our banker. They looked at our credit scores, our income, our down payment, our ability to afford to live in that house. Today, you fill out a few forms. They do some background checks or some various things they do. And then, you know, your loan gets packaged in a security that gets sliced and diced and gets sold at different securities around the world. And then we also saw the growing of what we call the outside financial sector, where you had these various intermediary lenders that would come into play on the lending side. Just about everything we do today, whether you're making a car loan, credit card loans, house loans, are sliced and diced, packaged, put into securities, and sold as a kind of bond instrument. And then on top of that, you have derivatives. So we had the financialization of the economy. A good example was General Electric, one of the largest industrial companies in the world and the United States. A good portion of their revenues by the end of the 90s came from GE's financial arm. And it was one of the reasons why, as an industrial company, they could deliver 14% earnings every single quarter, which is unusual for an industrial company, because almost half of GE's revenue was coming from the finance sector, its leasing company, and they were doing things other than being an industrial company. So that was one major change. The second change, it was also the age of inventory management, just-in-time inventory, where a lot of times you'll see this, and you're seeing it right now, a lot of the recessions in the past would occur when the economy would begin to slow down. Inventory would build up. As inventory built up, stuff wasn't moving out the doors. And then what companies would do is cut back on their manufacturing production until they worked off those inventory levels. Well, in the 80s and 90s, we got to just-in-time inventory, so you weren't overstocking. A third thing was the, as I mentioned, and this was related to the financialization of the country, which was financial innovation. Mortgages of all kinds, debt of all kinds, was basically repackaged and turned into a security rather than banks sitting on the loans in monitoring those loans. Today, banks make a loan, whether it's a car loan, it's a house loan, or even a credit card loan, and then they turn around and sell that debt and package it on Wall Street. And fourth is we saw fewer shocks in the 90s. We had, I'd probably say one of the biggest shocks was probably the stock market crash in 1987. But government came in with the Plunge Protection Committee, and they turned that thing around. There was confidence in the presidency, in politics. And then maybe the next shock, John, was probably the first Gulf War in recession of 1991. But even the shocks that we had in the 90s, the Asian crisis in, let's say, 1997, Russian bankruptcy, long-term capital management, 98, they were brief episodes. Basically, the market corrected in a one-day period, and that was it. We moved on. So there were fewer crises, both monetary crises, fiscal crises, and oil crises, and very little in the way of geopolitics. The Cold War had been won, and everybody was talking about the peace dividend. And then the other thing, too, and this goes back to the Time magazine article of 1999 showing Alan Greenspan, Robert Rubin, and Lawrence Summers on the front called the Committee to Save the World, because U.S. monetary policy was considered so effective. Anytime there was a crisis, well, the Fed printed money, the crisis went away and didn't last very long, whether it was Asia in 97, the peso crisis in 94, or even long-term capital management in Russia in 98. So there were changes in monetary policy, and this all led to two decades of growth where interest rates continued to fall, but they remained still at a moderate level, and we had lower levels of inflation and a lot of stability in the economy and the financial markets. In fact, it got to the point towards the end in the 90s when the public came into the market in 95, everybody was going to get wealthy in the new economy because the markets were going up double digits every single year. So that was referred to as the Great Moderation. There's no way that we're even close to that to where we are today.
What are some of the factors that are different than the 80s and 90s, which are contributing to the creation of this thing we're calling the new normal?
Well, I would say if there's one other thing I forgot to mention about the Great Moderation, during those business cycles from 1980 all the way up to the present period, debt began to accelerate, debt accumulation in each business cycle, and it really accelerated after 2008. There's a lot of talk about deleveraging, but if you take a look at since 2008 financial crisis, beginning in 2009, government debt is accelerating. The deficit will double under Obama by $10 trillion. That's a lot of stimulus. Corporate debt has escalated. It was in pretty good shape leading into the financial crisis, but now it has escalated. And consumer debt has really not gone down that much other than defaults. It just looks better today because asset values have risen as a result of monetary policy. The stock market is up over 200%. Housing prices are back up. So the level of consumer debt looks good if you compare it to asset prices. But it hasn't really gone down much. And where you've really seen an acceleration of debt is at the government and corporate level. So as a result of the debt that was accumulated in the previous decade, consumers are more debt adverse today. They're not taking on a lot of debt because a lot of boomers in their 50s or even in their 60s are heading into retirement with a lot more debt than their predecessors. So there's greater adversity to debt. And this is one of the problems the Fed has had, even despite lower interest rates, is revising the credit mechanisms in this country because there was just too much debt to begin with. The second thing that we're facing right now is a lot of global problems, as Don and I talked about in the first part of the big picture today, whether you're looking at Europe, Japan, or China. China was the world's growth machine in the last decade. Japan has been having problems for two decades, and now that area of debt in Japanese demographics are really impacting that country today. So that's a problem area that could implode along with Europe. And then the third, I think, is, you know, for the longest period of time, the federal funds rate basically moved within a range, 6% when the Fed was trying to tighten interest rates and leading us into a recession, and then they would lower rates to 3%. That was pretty much the trading range in the federal funds rate that lasted for decades. And then beginning with the bursting of the tech bubble, the Fed funds rate dropped to the lowest level in years, down to 1%. And then, of course, during the great financial crisis, it dropped down to 0.25%. And here we are, after 3 years of trying to raise interest rates, all the Fed has managed to do so far is raise interest rates 0.25%. We're at 50 basis points on Fed funds. And this is what we call the new normal. But John, really, the new normal is really the old normal. Because if you take a look at recessions in this country, going back to the end of World War II, the business cycle would last maybe 3 to 5 years. So in a decade, you would see, on average, 2 recessions. In sometimes, like in the 70s, you would see 3 or 4 recessions. So what we're going back to is the new normal is really the old normal, where we're going back to shorter business cycles and going away from this idea that the central banks and government policy had tamed the business cycle. Let me give you an example. Between 1950 and 1980, the U.S. economy experienced 8 recessions in 3 decades. Between 1980 and 1990, there was only 1 recession. Between 1990 and 2000, 1 recession. Between 2000 and 2009, we've had 2 recessions, and we're probably heading into another one.
Okay, but let's take the point of debt here, because I would assume that debt is one of the other reasons the economy has been as slow as it is, because if you're up to your eyeballs in debt, first of all, you have to service it. So that takes a lot of your assets and resources, and then work it off. And you don't have the capability to expand into other areas or to incur more debt. And so that what I would think contribute to a lot of what we're seeing in the economy.
Well, that was one of the big theses by Reinhardt and Rogoff in their book, This Time It's Different. And they pointed out that anytime you go through a major financial crisis, as we did during the Great Depression, or as we did recently during the Great Recession, you have slower economic growth. And the theory is once the debt is worked off, then things return back to normal. And this has been one of the problems, because that's been the broad consensus thinking, not only with central banks, with economists on Wall Street, and it goes beyond that, beyond the Fed, it goes to the IMF and the World Bank. All of these forecasts that have been made since the economic recovery began in 2009 have been wrong 90% of the time. How many times have we seen the Fed year after year say one thing, and as the year progresses, as things don't materialize in the way they projected, then they have to back off? Already this year, we began with 4 rate hikes that was predicted, and already the Fed has backed off 6 times. And as Don and I talked about, they really should have started raising interest rates back in 2012 and 2013 when the economy was much healthier and we would be in a better position today. But instead, they procrastinated, postponed, and here we are now, probably heading into another recession with the Fed funds rate at, let's say, 50 basis points. There really isn't much maneuverability in the next downturn. But what we're seeing now is the new normal. We've seen economic growth rates of 2%. That's probably a little bit different than what we saw coming out of World War II, where economic growth rates averaged 3 to 4% for an economy the size of the U.S. We've only been able to manage 2%, and now we are at stall speeds of 1%, which makes the U.S. economy very vulnerable, as well as the financial markets, to any kind of exogenous shock that could come in, whether it's geopolitical or financial. For example, Don talked about the referendum in Italy in December. What happens if Italy exits the euro? Then we're in another full-blown financial crisis. Or what's going on in Yemen right now between U.S. and Iranian warships? What if that erupts into a crisis? So the economy is more vulnerable today at stall speeds of 1%, because we've contended here, as long as you have economic growth, the economy is in a better position to absorb these exogenous shocks or rogue waves or black swans, whatever you want to call them, when it's growing. Less so when the economy is in a recession.
So what we do see here, though, Jim, is in a decelerating economy. We're actually running the risk of a recession right now. If you look at the leading economic indicators, which is absent from the political debate, there are risks to lower economic growth. It was interesting, by the way, there was an article in Der Spiegel on Friday, the German language edition, talking about Obama's miracle recovery of the economy, you know, starting back in 2008, etc. And as you read it, you go, are we operating in the same world here, you know, on what they're saying in the article versus what's going on? Candidates are promising that if you vote for them, everything's going to be wonderful. But there's this tension, if you see the reality of it, and the tension of what they're talking about is different. And the public is generally oblivious to that.
You know, it's rather interesting, John, because the Economic Cycle Research Center, which does a lot of work on economic recoveries, did a lot of research following the Great Recession. And one of the things that they were looking at, the new normal, and they came up with a couple things. They have found two patterns in the United States that have taken place over the last couple of decades. And one of those patterns is a trend to lower economic growth. It began in the late 90s and in the last decade, and it continues on in this decade. The second thing that they discovered was greater cycle volatility. And we've seen this in this economic recovery, where we'll have, let's say, the fourth quarter in the first quarter of the year, they tend to be, for some reason, economic growth goes negative or drops way down, as it did last year in the fourth quarter. It got down to 1%. In the first quarter, it got down to less than 1%. And here we are at 1%. And over the years, we've actually even had some quarters going back to 2012 and 2013 where we actually had a quarter of negative economic growth. So there's been greater cycle volatility. Now, why that's important is they did their research, taking a look at economic booms and busts over the last 65, 75 years, is when you have higher economic growth rates, as we did in the 80s and 90s, the result is you have fewer recessions. And that's exactly what we saw. Between 1980 and the year 2000, we only had two recessions, where if you look at a similar period between, let's say, 1950 and 1970, you had almost five recessions. The other thing they found is if you have lower cycle volatility, these kind of less corrective phases in the economy, you also have fewer recessions. And by the way, they found this trend was taking place in Europe, and it was also taking place in Japan. So the major Western countries were experiencing a series of lower trending economic growth and greater economic cycle volatility. So if you want to take a bird's eye view of looking at recessions and their frequency, there's only two ways that you can get fewer recessions. One is higher economic growth, and that's the one thing that the Fed and the government have been unable to do, which is incredible. Because when you think about it, when Obama leaves office, he will have added $10 trillion to the national debt. Another way of looking at that is the government has injected $10 trillion of stimulus into this economy, and the Fed has expanded its balance sheet by over $4 trillion. So you've had almost $14 trillion of economic stimulus, and we've had greater cycle volatility, we've had lower economic growth, and this economy has failed to get economic liftoff, which is one of the reasons why I think you're seeing so many individuals in this country unhappy about the way things are going financially. So there's only two ways, John, you're going to get fewer recessions. One is to raise economic trend growth to get back up over that 3%, 4% range, and to tamp down cycle volatility, which is something we have not seen in this economic recovery. Every single year of this recovery, with the exception of 2009, has seen this kind of cycle volatility quarter by quarter, depending on how much economic stimulus was being applied to the U.S. economy.
So the Great Moderation was different than previous cycles, say that cycle following World War II. But if you look at it, though, it would seem that the new normal is similar to the old normal, with one exception, and that is that economic growth rates are lower, which is why we see more recessions. We're not rebounding from them as robustly as maybe we did before, and why there's another one just ahead. So this is a trend.
It is. And there's a number of reasons why I think we're seeing what we're seeing today. Number one, growing debt and balances. And concomitant with that is government debt is growing larger and faster than the economic growth rate. Third, government is becoming a larger percentage of the economy. And we've seen this whether you look at Japan or you look at Europe. The larger the government becomes as a percentage of the economy, the lower the economic growth rates and the greater the unemployment rate. And no better example of that is look at Europe today, where the unemployment rate is well over 10%, in some cases 25%. And the economic growth rate, they've been at 0.5% more recessions and 1% growth rates, which is what we're now starting to see in the United States, as government debt expands, as regulations increase. And a third thing that we've seen is higher taxes and regulation. And we're talking about even more regulation and higher taxes, which leads to another thing that we've seen in this economic recovery is the fewer business formations. It's been the lowest level of new business formations in any economic cycle following World War II. And we all know that small businesses are the job creation machine in this country. It's not big companies. Big companies buy other companies. They merge. They lay off employees. The real economic growth engine in this country is small business, and they're being strangulated by taxes and regulation. And now we're talking about adding to those taxes and regulations. And the other thing is lower productivity. And so I think this is one of the reasons why, as you look forward, it's one of the reasons in the first part of the big picture, Don Cox has been so melancholy, and he's a historian by nature. It's because when you take a look at the real facts that we're not talking about, these are the questions the media should be raising in this presidential election. Instead, they're acting more like a gossip column than anything else, rather than raising these issues to the American people and let them know the economic storms and financial crises that lie directly ahead of us.
Well, given the new normal then and some of the crises that we see heading our way, the investors want to know what you do. How do you navigate in this particular environment?
Well, I think one of the things that we've seen, and I think we're going to continue to see, is lower economic growth rates. There's just nothing that I see on the horizon right now that will get us back to the normal growth rates that economists keep talking about, you know, that 3% and 4% level. It's just not in the cards. I think you're going to see shorter business cycles, so more frequent recessions. We're going to go back to the way it was coming out of World War II, when economic cycles lasted between 3 and 5 years, because I do think we're headed for another recession here soon. Third, I think you're going to see higher levels of unemployment. It took almost 7 years of this economic recovery to regain the jobs that were lost in the Great Recession. Number four, I think you're going to see more frequent bear markets, which go along with more frequent recessions. And number five is you're going to see more volatility in the markets, because a lot of these asset classes have gotten overinflated, with the exception of maybe precious metals, and you're going to see more sector rotation.
So how does it contrast from previous days? I mean, before you buy, you know, what, an S&P index fund and buy it and you just sit on it. So that's not going to work this time, I'm guessing.
Well, I think the days of passive investing are going to be over, because the more frequent the business cycle, the more disruptions that you have, the more recessions, the more bear markets. And I think it's a world where you're going to have to be much more active as an investor, as we've already seen in what we have called the RoRo trade, which is the risk on, the risk off trade. Right now, as our technicians have pointed here on the program, we're in the risk on trade. But I think very shortly, we're going to be going to the risk off trade, because I do feel that once we get into next year, the probability of a crisis and a recession are increasing by the day. And whether it's brought on financially or some exogenous event that we see in the Middle East, as you know, on this Friday, where we have U.S. warships right in the vicinity with Iranian warships, we're firing cruise missiles in another battleground area of Yemen that has opened up. So we've got Iraq in disarray. We've got Syria, a civil war and disruption in Libya, now Yemen. So the Middle East is becoming a cauldron, and you've got the same thing going on in Asia. So I think this is, once again, a reason why we are more on the defensive side, more on the active side. And you just have to be cautious here, as you heard Don Cox say, you know, we're raising cash and we're very defensive right now because the things that people should be worried about and talking about are not being raised by the media, who are acting more like gossip columnists than their true function of alerting people to what the real issues are.
And maybe that's the message that we all need to deliver to our friends, is to make them realize that they're not getting the full story from the media and that they need to understand that there are bigger things afoot and help them understand what that is. Although I did think it was interesting when Don Cox, when you were asking, well, what do we do, Don? He said, oh, go watch a sports game because it's just going to go the way it's going to go. And I thought, well, that's sort of a melancholy direction that we're headed out.
It's kind of like eat, drink, and be merry because tomorrow we die.
Yeah, exactly. You know, because here it goes and we might as well just enjoy what we're doing and let her rip. Anyway, what are we doing in the coming weeks? What are we looking forward? Here we are halfway through October, so we have 2.5 months to year's end.
Well, I still think in the next couple of weeks, we're right into the earnings season for Q3, so I think that's going to dominate some of the financial markets. I also think, as Luis Yamada is talked about in the first hour, that they'll keep the financial markets elevated at least through the election period. And then, you know, the country is going to be focusing on this election, which is, what is it now, John, 3 weeks away or 3 or 4 weeks away?
Yeah, it can't come soon enough.
Yeah, I mean, you know, silly season will finally be over. At least that will be one issue that's resolved, because it's very clear that you have two different economic perspectives here between both candidates. One wants lower taxes, decrease regulation. The other one wants to raise taxes, increase regulation. And then what will the Fed do come December? We'll also be watching the economic numbers as they come out for the end of the third quarter. So we'll look at GDP, what the unemployment numbers are going to be, and some of these economic PMIs that we've been following to see if they are getting ready to peak, as I suspect. All that's going to be coming up in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.